Hello everyone, I'm Jill Trebilcock and welcome to Cancel the Cabal on April Rain's We Raw Radio. We're also streaming through People's Internet Radio, Australian Internet Radio, and as I mentioned before, April Rain's radio. Today we have is our day that we work with our friend and psychiatrist who we need to help us with our problems, Professor Stuart Twemlow, who is a psychiatrist who specializes in bullying and the bystander effect these days, and who's interested in the impact of culture on bullying. Professor Twemlow is at a conference at the moment, I think. And anyway, tell us what are you up to? Welcome, Professor Stuart Twemlow.
Thanks very much, Joe.
Lovely to see you again,
Yeah.
though I can't see you at all.
Right.
Yes.
What am I doing here? What I'm up here doing is teaching a variety of professionals about personality disorders.
Oh, well, that's fascinating because I've got this theory, please straighten me, that most personality order disorders come from some sort of an attachment problem. How close am I?
Close. I
Right.
mean, the environment titivates the attachment issue.
Right.
But
And so
these
then,
disorders all reflect a problem in early attachment. And that is, I think probably the research has oversimplified attachment because so much of what goes on is nonverbal, and we don't really understand what attachment is in the case of a mother and a very tiny baby. But
Well,
it's
that's right.
magical and it's unusual and it's essential for a person to develop a sense of themselves as a unified being. And if they don't have a good caregiver, I use the word mother, by the way, just so you know, it's not a gender-related topic. Mother to me can be a man or a woman,
Yes.
but it's a person who takes care of the infant and puts the infant's life before their own. And these days, many men do that. Matter of fact, I was in a little town that parent of the year was a man who'd brought up three children on his own. And he, by the way, was a Green Beret in Vietnam. So the toughest of the tough can be good fathers and loving fathers and soft fathers and gentle fathers. And if you have that security built into your head at a very impressionable age, you can get through a lot of trauma, and I'm sort of thinking here as to whether I want to say what I'm going to say. I don't really want to, but just to tell you that my own background is a horrifying one. And if I didn't have a good adoptive mother who was as tough as nails and loved me, she's in a picture beside my bed, died when I was 10 years of age. I would be dead in a back ward of a mental hospital. I'm not going to go into the details of it all, but I'm going to tell you that that secure attachment has to be present. Now, if a child grows up feeling securely attached, they have a sense of themselves, they can cope with just about anything. And I'm a living example of that. And
Well,
the fact of the matter is, when you get a situation where, somebody can't cope, I mean, our whole medical profession deals with those who can't cope, but they wouldn't be even 20% of the population as a whole, Jill. 80%
can't cope.
of the population does very well with trauma of extraordinary complexity, and I'm an example of that. We tend to forget the majority of people do well, and we know
Well, I be
nothing about
go on.
normal behavior, which is one of the things that interests me, because everything has been focused on the sick. Why would you study the normal person? They're doing fine. We need to study the sick. The trouble is these days there's so much coming out in the prevention area. What we know is that we don't know much about prevention because we don't know much about how people who cope well do. And that's at least 70% of our population. About 20% have a variety of physical and mental disabilities. And about 10% are just not with it. I mean, they ain't going to be part of a community. And
Well, it's
I always
funny,
believe what we need to
go on.
study is the 70%,
Yes,
the normal.
they're our role models.
They should be, but we can't have them as role models because we know almost nothing about them. We know quite a bit about role models from Sweden and Norway because those two countries kept records since 1970, early 1970s. We kept no records because, of course, that would interfere with privacy. So we have no knowledge of what the average American is like, or for that matter, the average Australian. It's the same in your country.
Well, I'm very surprised because I thought that the well-being was being studied a lot. In Australia, even in our schools, we actually have well-being classes now.
Yes, you
And
do.
yeah, and I thought that wellness and well-being was actually had made mainstream psychiatry. So I'm sorry for psychiatry if it's so behind the times.
Well,
And
it's
I'm
not
glad you're bringing them
right.
up to speed.
What I want to say to you, though, Jill, is this. It's not psychiatry. Psychiatry has nothing to do with wellness. Most of that stuff is done by pediatricians, very, very high percent pediatricians, and internists. It's a medical dilemma. It's not just psychiatrists. All physicians only study sick people.
It's true.
So do all pediatricians. They
Maybe.
See more normal people than the average surgeon or the average internist. The whole medical profession knows nothing about wellness. And the way you can find that out is 90% of the programs, if you Google wellness, are made up by businessmen trying to make a buck out of somebody who's going to give a dollar and learn 10 well things to do. Those 10 well things to do, you wouldn't have to have a fifth grade education to think up. It's a scam. And it covers the fact that we know almost nothing about healthy behavior. The only area where it's as underfunded, but if I was in the government, this is what I'd spend my money on. Not cancer, not heart disease, not Alzheimer's disease, not AIDS. I would put all my money into resilience.
Yeah, I knew you were going to
bounce back. Those are the people that are normal. Those are the 70% who do well, whatever happened. Doesn't matter. They'll put up with the worst abuse you can imagine, and they'll bounce back.
Except they won't take the abuse in the very beginning, because that is where I really think that Harlow's monkeys are good. You know, those horrific experiments that he did really do show, you know, how the – I was explaining to Stephen the other day, we were talking about narcissism, and I was saying how, you know, the different monkeys behaved in that attachment as an example to him, and how really important it is, as you were saying, Stuart, with your attachment mother, the mother you had for the first 10 years, how if you have a secure hip and some secure arms and a secure mind,
and you
to
know,
help
I
you.
Have somebody, you know, not only, you know, I'd put mine first, Jill.
Yes.
I have
yes.
a picture of my adoptive mother, not my biological mother,
on
my bedside, and I'm 72 years of age. I look at her every evening. She died when I was 10. She keeps.
How old were you when you got her, Stuart?
What?
How old were you when you were given to her?
Four.
Four. So those first 4 years are very formative, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And I didn't have, I had actually, well, I don't want to go into the details of it.
All right, we won't. But the point that I'm interested in is, like, I completely believe that people, I've been looking at narcissism a lot lately, and I've decided, it goes like this. You're terrified, you're the monkey, you hide in the corner, you know, you're too scared to explore your world.
Yeah.
The bit I don't, and that includes exploring all the different aspects of your mind, I'm assuming. But at some point, when you get the basic security, because humans have this drive to thrive and to reach homeostasis, that at some point, even if it's very belated, that narcissists, anybody, can be cured as long as they can get secure enough to reach out and rewire their neural pathways. What do you reckon?
That is the hope. You would be on the cutting edge of resilience research. What you just said is what resilience workers hope. We cannot say for sure, but it points in that direction, that you can reparent a disturbed person.
Yes.
That used to be doubted. It's now pretty much established. You can really change a person with very serious early problems.
Yes.
And you might be interested in one study was done of 300 kids. They ranged in age. I can't remember how they were selected. I think they were selected based on having normal IQs. And they were followed up about 4 or 5 of age until they were actually, they're now be in their 40s.
Yes.
And they all came. They all had parents who were prostitutes or in prison or gamblers and abusive, and many of them had to pass drugs to survive, and they had no home life and nobody that loved them. They had awful lives, all of them.
Yes.
And out of that sample, I think they had several thousand of them. 300 were selected based on what they were doing when they were 20. These 300 were all in college, now in 40s. The whole of them are all highly qualified professionals, teachers, attorneys, physicians, well-educated, make a good living, have a happy family. They've tried to characterize them. What is it that deviates from normal? And, of course, these workers don't know, because we don't know what normal is. But what they do know is these people are moody. Their self-esteem is much more fluctuant than one would think a normal person's self-esteem would be. They do very quickly. Other than that, they're as strong, their bounce back is incredible, they're known, they're in their work, they're often driven. I mean, they fit the workaholic model, and they're at the top of their professions because they work hard. I don't know if they're working hard to avoid conflict, but whatever it is, they were the ones that I think are the wave of the future. They're the ones that make up the 80% who do well with sexual abuse, who may be sexually abused on a regular basis and grow up with no need for psychotherapy whatsoever. A few studies have tried to start that. One of the last things the Menninger Clinic did when it was based in Kansas was have selected quite a large sample of girls who'd been severely sexually abused regularly throughout their early life. And they were starting to follow them because these girls had gone through school fine and had no troubles. And so we need to focus our attention on the healthy and what it is they do. Prevention really is, to me, it's not how do you stop from being a piece of a slob, sort of fat, hypertensive, heart disease ridden individual. It's how do you manage to bounce back? Everybody has horrifying experiences. What about the group that bounced back? And that, I think, is where the wave of the future research should be, but it isn't. Of course, why? Because we basically have awful disease in our culture, heart disease, cancer, AIDS, Alzheimer's. Something went on with Alzheimer recently. I didn't see it, but the news said some ghastly factual discovery just came to light that made women absolutely more prone to Alzheimer's than anybody else. And that, it's like we know all about these illnesses that are horrible. That's where our money goes, just to try and stay alive. But what you don't yet buy is that you won't stay alive unless you study the people that stay alive in spite of a horrifying experience or a dreadful childhood or the worst genes in the world.
Yeah, but that's interesting because a lot of the funding into medicine probably comes from the pharmaceutical companies. So they're not interested.
They're not going to fund stuff for normal people.
Pardon?
So, who's going to have to do that? The damn federal government, Jill. That's what we have a government for, to fund research that other people won't fund because there's nothing in it for them to make a living. I don't blame drug companies for not funding prevention research. I don't blame them. There's nothing in it for them. But I do blame governments that don't fund it. And that's, to me, what government money assigned to research should be used for.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And it's so important to study resilience, as you were saying, because there's so many, it's almost like people have been studying health and resilience for thousands and thousands of years. And then in terms of all the herbal medicines and all the...
meditative traditions, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, we've had all these sort of ghastly reformations, like with the Chinese, and they went and destroyed all the Mao, they had the Great Leap Forward and all the things they did where they just destroyed all the wisdom. And then in Europe, I always look, or in England, I always look at how they destroyed so much of the, when they burnt all the witches and the 11
Absolutely.
Million people.
Yeah, the Dark Ages. Yeah.
Yes. So we lost our wisdom. People, it was just like they did in China. They destroyed our wisdom holders.
Japanese, have this way of classifying people. I think it's the only country in the world that does this. They classify people as living treasures. That's what they're called, living treasures.
And
the areas of pottery, origami, sword making, and I think calligraphy. And if you're a living treasure, it's like being a historic house. The government will fund you for the rest of your life to practice an art that the culture has said cannot be lost.
Absolutely. Well, I hope they have the Japanese doctors in there too.
I don't think doctors are in there.
They should have the Japanese-Chinese doctors because even Japanese acupuncture, someone was just saying to me the other day they were going to study Chinese Japanese medicine because they actually hadn't had their traditions wiped out apart from by...
They're not. The Japanese are very careful to preserve themselves. They're much less flexible than the Chinese. So that doesn't surprise me to hear that.
Well, and they didn't have a big wipeout of the culture,
no.
Though they did have a sellout to the pharmaceuticals, probably, because
they
did
had
sell
a
out
sellout to the Nazis. Well, that is not made, as you know. Japan is only just now talking about having an actual military, because they've been stopped as part of the armistice after World War II. They were not allowed to have a military. That was part of their surrender agreement. Japanese have a lot of history to live down. And the way they treated the Chinese was horrifying. You ought to look at, there's a book written called The Rape of Nanking. And I hardly recommend it to you because it's so awful to read. How the Japanese abused Chinese women in a way that would have made Hitler look gentle. And so the Japanese have a lot to live down. This latest president is he's
Have
a
a good.
sensible guy, but boy, he may be moving a little too fast.
Oh, okay.
Japan has to
Okay.
be very humble for a little while longer. Do you know, and this is a free associative sidebar, that as part of the armistice agreement with Japan and Germany, every Holocaust survivor is paid a significant amount of money every month by the German
Hello.
government directly.
Oh, I didn't know
That
that.
was set up was it had to be a check from the German government, not to America, and then America distributes it. Just to remind every German who wrote the check who they put in death camps. And that money goes on forever to every Holocaust survivor's immediate family. The German government is liable to support them completely.
All right, I'm going to segue this straight back. I believe that straight back to narcissism in Jewish people, because they've all been so damaged.
Very, very damaged. And you see, Japanese were part of Hitler. They aligned themselves with Hitler. So they
right.
have to be doubly careful about becoming aggressive in the world scene anymore. But anyway, I mean, I do
Good.
Japanese martial arts. All the martial arts I do are Japanese. So I'm not
Right.
in Japan.
No.
So I'm just saying, politically, they have to be incredibly careful.
So, Stuart, I agree, but I want to bring you back to psychiatry, which is most people listen to you because you're a psychiatrist.
Oh, what a pity. I'd rather not call. You know what I think of myself as?
What?
Not a psychiatrist. I think of myself as a physician and a martial artist and a humanist.
I love the
Not a
fact you're a
psychiatrist at all.
I love humanists. What's so good about humanists?
Well, because they're always open to anything good that comes along. They'll look at something focused on the welfare of people and the way in which the quality of life can be improved. And they are not sidebarred by politics and ideologies of various sorts, including religious ideologies. The early humanists were all atheists. And, I mean, you don't have to be an atheist now.
No, and that's a problem, because humanists are such a fabulous thing, and yet Christians are anti-humanists because they think that to be a humanist means that you're actually atheist, but it doesn't.
What?
They just happen to correlate, but correlation does not prove causation. You know, it's not being
Absolutely.
anti-Christ.
What?
Yeah.
Why in God's name, to me, I mean, why does it matter if you're a Christian or not a Christian? The main thing
Exactly.
is that you are a humanist.
You've got the central message. You have
But
the ethic of
right.
compassion.
It would be if I was to criticize you for being a Tibetan nun because you're a Tibetan nun. For God's sake, Joe, what common sense does that make? None. You see, I don't get the reasoning of this sort of ideologies that are so stereotyped and label people just because their skin is not white or they're not Christians or.
Well, we can take that back to attachment, can't we? Because in that original attachment, Stuart, would you like to explain the Harlow monkey experiment and how, you know, the difference between the, that would be lovely. Would you talk about that for a minute, please?
Yeah. So what
Thanks.
Happened was this. I think a Canadian, Harlow, he was basically an animal researcher. He was not a clinician. He worked with, as I believe, rhesus monkeys, and they were popular because they are intelligent monkeys. And I think they're now actually banned from use in the United States because they're too intelligent. So the animal activists have got to NIMH, or NIH, but whatever it was. He worked with them. And this is what, just for the audience, are called animal models. And what an animal model is to get an animal as close to human biology as you can get. And you can do experiments on animals that you can't do on human beings. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, it's legally.
A rude thing to
because,
say, but you can be cruel to animals and you can't be to human beings.
Well, when you say you can, it means we're legally allowed to, but we're all mad to do it anyway.
Right.
But yeah,
we're
let's go
allowed
on.
To hurt, hurt animals and for the good of humans. It's getting harder and harder in America. So
I know you're not allowed to torture rabbits anymore for cosmetic experiments.
Yeah.
It only came out a couple of days ago.
That's correct.
Yeah,
well,
go
anyway,
on.
These rhesus monkeys were subject to the following experiment. Harlow set it up so. A number of pregnant monkeys had their babies, and one group of them were assigned to their mothers to bring them up. And the other group were assigned to a model that was like a mother and had soft, furry cloth on it. It was actually made of wire, and it felt like a mother, but it was not alive. And the
Yeah, but it had the furry tactile part, which we forget
correct.
what physical beings we are.
And that's what, they thought was important. So that, and it was also soft. It could be molded by the monkeys. The little baby monkeys clung on to these wire mothers.
But
And
then they had a wire one as well, Stuart. They had a furry one, and then they had a wire one that was
yeah.
plain wire.
Well, you
Yeah,
see,
go on.
that's just a control. The
Yeah.
main issue is, I mean, we don't, from the point of view of your audience, that's, the issue really is this. The question then was how well adjusted were the monkeys when they grew up? How well adjusted were the wire brought up monkeys that had a tactile surface and the ones brought up by live monkeys who were their mothers?
Right.
And the ones who just had a wire, I think were crazy.
They went crazy. What happens was when somebody came into the room, they'd bring an object into the room, and the monkeys that
Terrified.
only had wire would just crawl into a ball.
Terrified. So here's
Yeah.
the issue. The issue is that
But explain what the second one did. Yeah, go on.
the least terrified monkeys were the ones that had their own mothers. The next more terrified ones were ones that had furry mothers, and the most terrified were the ones that had wire mothers. And
Yeah,
it was
the cold, hard,
very, very,
disconnected.
very extreme. And it was expressed
Extreme.
by fear. Fear.
Yes.
Simple as that. No trust that the environment would be kind and supportive and loving and parental.
Yes.
See, that became an animal model that was so important to biology and to human evolution, even though these were monkeys. And, there are people who simply say that experimental work is not valid. And there's a good reason to say that. You
What's the
can't
good
just
reason?
take an animal and say humans are going to do this. But the model was simply that the baby to survive has to have a secure, safe environment, what Fonagy calls a secure attachment. And it's as simple as this. You have a baby, something scares it, it turns immediately to the mother, it forms a bond with the mother, the scariness goes down, and the baby feels secure, close to the mother. In other words,
Yep.
attached to the mother. It's not complicated. The mother makes the baby feel safe. What is safe? Safe is won't be killed.
Yep.
Primitive as that. Now, this work of Harlow had influenced an enormous amount of psychological research.
Yes.
Because, and that's where attachment work, I don't know whether John Bowlby knew much about Harlow. I think he did. I had a chance to meet him before he died. Of course, we didn't talk about that, but
He started the Menninger Clinic, did he?
yeah, he came to the Menninger Clinic.
Yeah.
Basically, he did the early work on a similar sort of attachment behavior in humans.
Yes.
And he worked a lot for the World Health Organization, wrote several volumes on maternal attachment and deprivation of maternal attachment, and coined the concept of hospitalism, which is when a small baby is deprived of contact with its mother in a hospital, it has to go in there for some long-term reason, that it becomes regressed and very primitive.
So go
But
and sleep
it
with your
doesn't
babies,
survive.
Mum.
The early work done in World War II showed that some of these babies died from what was called by the British, of course, who make up names for diseases, called marasmus, which really
Marasmus.
literally means dying from lack of love.
They fell into the morass, the great morass of maternal deprivation.
Is that what that means?
Yes, I think the great, it's like morass, the great morass, the great empty, empty,
That's
it's
right.
not a nice empty, it's where we get the wrong view of voidness from.
These kids had the best of physical care. I mean, British nurses, they had every nutrient you could imagine, every vitamin you could imagine. The only thing is they didn't have a loving mother. And they died.
Yeah, absolutely. And I used to, and I think maternal, I used to call it maternal deprivation. But I realized, Stuart, that we all are narcissists. I've got no doubt about that. It's a sliding scale. It's a spectrum, the same as autism.
Yeah.
And it's all to do with this attachment. What do you reckon?
I think you're right. We're all narcissistic to some degree. I mean, narcissism, self-love is necessary.
Yes.
Not going to face the dilemma of Camus. You're like Sisyphus climbs up the hill with a rock and can't get over the top. He drops it.
Yeah.
Don't want a life of utter hopeless repetition of a task that never gets completed.
Exactly.
But, yeah, we want to feel like there's some purpose in what we're doing. And
achievement.
So my idea is that the way mental health care will be delivered in the future, and by future I'm talking 30 years hence.
Yes.
The science has not caught up with us yet. It will
Is with
be
parenting.
A massive set of community networks that take
Yes.
care of people who cannot cope.
Absolutely, because
They won't be called mental health centers. It will not be called psychiatric treatment. It will be called containment and resilience promotion.
What do you mean by containment, Stuart?
Okay. Let's say you came to me acutely disturbed because your husband had just beaten you up. He had a black eye. You were angry. You were crying. You felt humiliated. You knew that you loved him, but you were humiliated by the horror that this man you loved would do something so awful to you.
Yeah.
And you were crying and you were pissed off at the same time.
And unsafe and wanting to go back.
And you want to go back, but you know if you do, you're going to get beaten up again. So you come in to see a therapist. Now, here's containment.
I've done exactly that, Stuart. I went to a psychiatrist for 3 visits when I was younger, before I was 30, because I lived with a man who hit me, and I went to go and see why I couldn't leave him.
And you know, a good therapist will contain you. And here's what containment is.
Yeah.
You say, listen, he did this, he did that. I feel this, I feel that. I can't stand it. What should I do? Yep. Call the police? Will you mind calling the police for me? And the psychiatrist says, you're very upset, aren't you? And you say, well, you idiot, know that. I mean, what I've said. And he says, you know, I feel for you. I feel that your reaction to what your husband has done is completely justified.
Yes.
And he deserves to go to jail. But my main interest is not in him. It's in you.
Yes.
What I want to know is, what are you going to now do, having reached this decision that he's violent and dangerous? It's not the first time he's done it. You're here for what reason? If I was a good therapist, if I'm not a good therapist, I would tell you the reason.
Yeah, exactly.
I said, for what reason? You would say, well, I want to learn how to leave him and still feel I can survive okay. Because part of what keeps you attached to him is the feeling you can't survive without him.
Yes.
And that good psychiatrist would say, interesting idea. Here's what I will do. I will help you achieve that strength.
Yes.
That's
I'll contain you. Yeah, I'll support you.
I will contain you.
I will help you achieve, realize, get
here's
that strength.
Here's my cell phone number. I'm open to you 24/7.
Yeah. And that's why they do that.
That's containment.
That's containment, right. Well, if only we could contain all of our difficult friends like that, what a beneficial society we would be. And this is what you're saying is that we could do this.
Go to medical school for 6 or 10 years or, you know, I always say you don't have to go to 8 years to get a black belt in karate to learn to defend yourself.
Yes.
Those are for the people who want the detail. The issue is, it's fairly straightforward if you get a good therapist. I was just asked, literally before we started, a young man who's got into a very good institution to train him in psychology. He's very bright. He's very skilled with people. And he asked me, where should he go to for psychoanalysis? And I said, look, it's not where you go. It's who you go to. And I know him well enough to know the sort of therapist to refer him to, never mind where they were trained. It's all very personal. If you're lucky enough to get the containing figure the first time you try, good on you.
Well, you know, even social work in Australia is, I know some people who've just started doing social work. I told you I was going to do it, but I'm actually going to India, Stuart. I'm going to India for a couple of months later in the year with both of my sons.
Oh, how nice.
Which is, yes, it is nice. But in terms of containment, this is something that I'm always trying to work on in myself, to not give people advice, but to do it in exactly the containing way that you were saying, in which you keep on saying to them, are you here? Yeah, you have all the answers. And this is what social welfare is doing now, and that is allowing it to be self-directed by the person who knows their own needs better than anyone else.
And knows how to make those needs come true.
And knows how to make those needs come true.
And that's what a therapist does.
And that's what a therapist does.
Yeah. See, this is what a website won't do. A recipe will not do. It will tell you what you need to do, and most of the time, what is said on the website, the recipe approach, as I call it, is correct. If you do those things, you will be better. The fact is, to actually get yourself to do them is the problem. The only psychologist that I've ever heard of who ever dropped it, that was Sigmund Freud. And you know what? Do you know the story of how Freud managed to get onto the stuff that made him famous? Maybe your
No.
listeners will be interested in this.
We will. Stuart, I just got a Skype message then, and I just missed what it was that you said that Freud was the only person who was able to do it. What was it that Freud was the only person able to do?
Here's what I'll tell you the story, and this is epitomized for Freudians who are listening in the case of Anna O, A-N-N-A-O, anonymous patient. She was a patient in early in Freud's career when he was supervised by a very famous neurologist by the name of Joseph Breuer, and he followed Breuer around from case to case. This particular woman had a lot of psychosomatic problems. She had a lot of asthma. She had aches and pains, lots of somatic issues. And he hypnotized her, and all of the
Oh,
disappeared.
so
A
that's
couple of
what
days
some other.
later, they'd all come back again. And she'd call up and say, "I need you again, hypnotize me." It all disappeared. And so Breuer was going around, and Freud was following around like a student, hypnotizing her every couple of days. And then,
That
well, let me,
sounds funny.
it gets funnier.
Yeah.
Breuer, the famous neurologist's wife, got jealous of the amount of time he was spending with his patient.
Right.
She's a very attractive young lady. And she began to question Breuer about it in a way that led to family troubles. So Breuer said to Freud, "Listen, I have to take my wife on a second honeymoon to Switzerland. Do you think you can manage my practice?" And Freud, of course, I mean, this guy was. That's another whole story. Freud was the most brilliant student the university and high school and elementary school had ever had. He skipped high school. He was utterly beyond description in terms of intellect. And so everybody was fighting for him. And he said, "Yeah, well, I'll do what I can." So Breuer went off to Switzerland and took his wife. So he got Anna O. Realized Anna O talked to him about how much she loved Breuer and how much she wanted to have his baby. What she did was she started to swell in her abdomen. She developed a size that was a 9-month pregnancy. It's called a pseudocyesis, false pregnancy. And this baby was not a baby, but it was Breuer's child. Each time she submitted to Breuer, she was saying, "Why don't you have sex with me and then we'll have a baby and then you can marry me and then we'll be happy." But Breuer didn't see it, and Freud called it transference, and
He
he
called
began to
that
see that
transference.
she was acting out a fantasy with his esteemed colleague that really was a fantasy. And to cut a long story short, he took over her treatment and began to manage the fantasy of pregnancy. That's how the Oedipal complex was discovered,
The Oedipal
fantasy
complex.
of impregnation by the father. And that's how transference was discovered.
I thought that was the Electra complex. I thought that
No such
the
thing.
Oedipal.
There's no Electra complex. That's a
So
thing
the Oedipal
other people
complex
thought of.
is usually, but it was switched. Well, it was switched in terms of gender from, the male child wanting to have sex with his mother
Well,
to the girl
no,
wanting
the
to.
girl wants to have sex with her father.
Wants to bear her father, but it's always described the other way around,
Well, not
as in the story of Oedipus, the
yeah, but
myth.
the point, I mean, the story of Oedipus was Oedipus. Oedipus was a male, not a female. The issue
Yes.
about that is Electra was a subsequent commentary by a non-Freudian analyst. Freudians have never considered Electra complexes. The
Okay, but so why?
big
But
issue is that the female wants to have sex with her father. That's one
no,
of
I never
the reasons,
did.
Jill, the majority of sexual abuse is between father or father substitutes and young daughters, not between mothers and sons, even though that's much more common than we thought.
All right,
It
well,
is
listen,
a
I want to take.
male-female bonding. The point was, Freud realized that because Breuer disappeared and he saw the pregnancy that she had fantasized. And that out of that came the understanding of transference and later countertransference. That's how psychoanalysis evolved. Just by clinical experience. Freud was fundamentally a clinician, and actually, by the way, not a very good clinician. He wasn't very good at psychoanalysis. He was too interested in the science of it, but he observed enough about people to lay the fundamentals down, and those are the fundamentals, things people do that they are not aware of.
So let's go into somatic narcissism then, because that's what we seem to be talking about. So that's somatic, isn't it? That would be somatic narcissism, the
Yeah, in the
somatic
sense of
narcissist. So how would that arise in a young child? Let's go back to the beginning and Harlow's monkeys, and a child that develops like narcissism as being a completely healthy phase, right? It's innate. Everybody has a narcissistic phase, even in the healthiest of maternal sort of support and father, you know, familial support, don't they? Like we go through a narcissistic phase, and then we have to integrate all these aspects of our psyche.
And the analyst who first described that in detail was called Melanie Klein.
Mm-hmm.
She was I think Bulgarian who came to live in England, established a school of psychoanalysis still active in England, not very popular in America, but whatever. What she said was a person becomes a person from an infant
mm-hmm.
when they realize that their mother is both good and bad. It's called
yes.
depressive position.
Depressive
it's very
position.
It's very depressing for a child to realize that all these years, according to Klein, she's hated the mother in a paranoid way, and then suddenly realizes in the depressive position that the mother is both good and bad, is there to help her and occasionally makes mistakes. And
mm-hmm.
suddenly the child has to face the idea that they are not their mother.
Mm-hmm.
They see their mother as good and bad instead of all good or all bad. In the early Kleining theory is the mother is seen as all bad, which I don't think is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, by the depressive position, and that's supposed to occur about 7, 6, 7, 8 months of age, the child suddenly has this realization that reality is their parents aren't perfect.
Mm.
And that realization is very, very important for the growth of a child because it lets them see how all of the different people they attach to may be both good and bad. And it helps the child to develop a sense of having to provide for themselves safety as opposed to look for some sort of mother figure. And people,
and they're only just at crawling age then, aren't they? Or just about to walk, you know? So
they have to do it to survive. The sort of personality disorders that don't do it are dependent. They move from one person that can be their mother to another, and then to a spouse.
Mm. And that's like you meet these young kids that have been abused, and they always want to hug you and tell you they love you all the time.
That's correct. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm, just looking for something that they can hang on to, and then that can
so they don't have to face the fact that you're an imperfect being who's probably going to do something that hurts them.
So where's somatic narcissism coming to this?
Well, if a person cannot give up the idea that the world is not going to... Narcissism is the fear that the world will not be the way you want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're bright enough, you can manage that fantasy and choose a job like going and belonging to a university faculty where you end up teaching, you know, one class a semester and the rest of the time coming in late and leaving early and titivating your curriculum vitae, not really working very much. This is the old ways universities used to be. You can spend till middle age thinking you're the world's, that you're the gift to the world, but you're not. And
so we're developing a false self. A false self comes in here.
Yeah. What is confronted, the false self has to realize your marriage is not very good. You've not got tenure in the university yet. You've not produced any earth-shattering discoveries. You're already 59, 49, and you're still really not very well established as a famous person. Then you come to the doctor and you say, listen, my wife, my marriage is okay, but she doesn't turn me on anymore. My job's okay, but I couldn't get tenure. And, you know, I still have a job, and it's an easy job, but I don't like going. You know, I don't go till 11 in the morning now. I'm home by 2. Now, see, in universities, you used to be able to do that. Anymore, universities are not good places to be because you can't do that.
Well, let's talk about it in a different situation other than a university. Let's just be a builder or something.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you're a builder and you are narcissistically disordered, I'm assuming that's what you're suggesting, then it's not going to be any different.
No.
You're going to come in and say, you know, my marriage is not as good as I think I deserve, and my job I used to like, but I don't like it anymore, and I feel like I'm just trailing along doing nothing.
Yeah.
It's no different. The reason I brought up university, Jill, was because that's where it was discovered.
Right.
It can happen.
Yeah, no, I shouldn't have gone there, Stuart. Sorry.
Construction worker is exactly the same. That's pathological narcissism. And the reason university people were studied was because there ain't no job in the world like a university job in the old days, when you would sit around, do almost nothing, complain about teaching 2 hours a week, and act like you're overworked. That doesn't happen much anymore in universities, but it used to. So there are generations of faculty members who've never really worked for a living, and they've careered along being paid a lot of money for doing almost nothing. And
right.
Not happy. I mean, they were many, many people. When I worked in places with major universities and medical schools, those were more than half of my patients like that. They weren't construction workers in general.
Yeah.
But
all right. So bringing it back to where we were, we're talking about how you develop a false self and basically how community, because we've got to wrap up soon, how community can help people, how can community steward help people develop overcome the false self so that they feel empowered enough to make some achievements that they're not ashamed of themselves in?
Well, I mean, I could answer you in one of two ways. I could give you a recipe, and then you feel satisfied, and then I can tell you the truth. I don't know.
Why would you give me the recipe to satisfy
Because
me?
It will make you
when
happy.
The truth will
You'll
set
feel
me
okay.
free.
You'll feel like,
I
oh,
want...
yeah, now I know what to do.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we'll
I
do both.
I have no idea how to do that.
Oh, exactly.
That's not totally true. I have some idea.
Yes, well,
fact,
let's go with this.
I'm in the middle of doing some research, hopefully with Center for Disease Control funding and National
yes.
and Department of Justice funding.
Yes.
But there's pipeline between school and prison.
Pipeline
very,
between
very
school.
Problematic for children in the United States, particularly
yes.
Puerto Rican children.
Yeah.
I'm looking at, you know, answers to those questions. But what I can tell you is if you get your favorite website and it tells you how to do it, if you believe it, you're finished.
Well, the bottom line is we're looking for secure attachment, aren't
of
we?
Of course we are, and we can't
exactly.
demand it. It
no, we can't.
Happen.
We just, yeah, we have to
yeah.
be supportive. Like, as individuals, we need to stand up and you look
and
after
say, our scientists, whom we think are going to help us survive into the future through their extraordinary discoveries, and if we give them enough Nobel Prizes, they will do it. The fact is, Jill, they are almost completely ignorant.
I agree. I know what you're saying. Because they're the wire monkey.
Yeah.
And we want the real loving humanity, the monkeyness in us, to be able to love and support the other person. Like, a monkey doesn't sit around and criticize another monkey because it's
no.
being weird. It just looks at it and pats it and kisses it every now and then.
And it will only fight the other monkey when there is a social order to be reestablished.
Exactly.
As soon as that's reestablished, the monkeys will pat each other and kiss each other and hug each other.
Exactly.
That will be that. The fight will stop. Only help
you and me, Stuart, when you bash me up. Stuart?
Yeah, what?
Like when you bash me up.
When did I bash you up?
You've had to straighten me out a couple of times for talking over you or not.
Oh, yeah, talking over me, but you still do that. And you
I
did
know.
That today several times. But it no longer annoys me.
Well, you won't let me. You just keep talking on anyway. I can't.
You know, you, yeah. Well, you want me to give you this. So you're the interviewer. So I got used to you.
Well, sometimes
right.
I do like.
Yeah, I will, you know, those sort of things. But the major point here is that we're not monkeys. We have enough brain to become horribly intelligent and sadistically intelligent and get pleasure from inflicting pain on others. And that's why the human condition needs some modification. I don't know if you've ever been sadistically aroused. I'm not going to ask you because.
No, I haven't. I can tell you quite frankly.
Well, that's okay. You don't have
yeah.
to tell me.
Just we've only got 3 minutes. I mean, I might have been ever so slightly, but
Excellent.
It's not my modus operandi.
That's correct. Okay. Well, let me just finish what I was saying. What I was trying to say was this. There is an excitement in sadism.
Yes.
It's a very, very positive feeling. The idea that only a monster would feel sadism is truly stupid.
Look, from a from an emptiness, you know, like a surrender.
We have to realize we are bad people to realize that we are good, and that's the end.
Well, I realized that when I was a small child. I was
you didn't
fierce.
Realize it enough. You and I will talk until we can say what it is you need to realize. It's not intellectual. just...
But I'm very vicious. I still have a very vicious fierce side.
I know you do. I've seen it.
It's good. We've got to wind up. Let's wind up. Will we wind up on that, Stuart? Or do
absolutely.
You have something else?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, now I have to get really serious and try and remember everything I have to say. Professor of Psychiatry, Stuart Twemlow, thank you so much once again for coming and gracing us with your great wisdom. And Stephen Roberts, April Rains, We Raw Radio, People's Internet Radio, and Australia Internet Radio. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Good night, everyone.